all CEOs, me included, we don't actually know what we're doing.
They're all sharks, so all you got to do, though, is know shark behavior.
I don't think we've ever talked about this before.
We can capture all of the wallet share.
First place you start is with the product.
That's just the first nut.
This is the Capital Stack.
Hey, everybody. This is David Paul, the host of the Capital Stack podcast, where I talk to founders, operators, and investors about all things value creation in startups. I'm also going to venture out a little bit and start talking a little bit more about founders and investors' relationship with capital, which is a new type of foray, a little bit bigger focus, but in a world where capital is more scarce and harder to come by, I feel that it's a really great conversation to have, because ultimately the type of capital that a founder takes is ultimately going to determine kind of the outcome of their business. And nobody has been able to master the art of capital allocation better than Vikram Pradhan of Soberus Capital. Vic, how are you?
I'm doing great, David. Thanks for having me on.
You might know Vic from Vic's Picks, which is a Substack focusing on different elements of healthcare. Vic, how long have you been with Soberus?
I've been with Soberus for a little over 5 years now. I joined the team in 2018.
So to get started, why don't you tell us a little bit about kind of yourself and your foray into investing, as well as kind of what you do over at Soberus?
Happy to. So I grew up outside of Chicago, moved to New York for college, and I got my start in investing actually freshman year of college. I started working at a hedge fund. I would end up working there throughout my college career, part-time during the school year and then full-time during the summer. And I think that's where I really learned what it means and looks like to be a good investor, and realized that's what I wanted to do with my career. So after college, I spent a couple of years in private equity in a role where we looked at all kinds of different investments, from sort of traditional buyouts to real estate to even some public company special situation type investing. Great opportunity to learn the ropes, and then decided to go earlier stage and join the team at Soberus, which is an early stage healthcare focused venture capital firm that's been in existence for a little over 20 years. And I found it to be a great fit. I wasn't doing healthcare specifically before, but it's always been an area of interest for me. And I found it to be a great firm with a great sort of strategy and execution and all that. So that's the story of how I ended up there, and have been there for now, like I said, a little over 5 years.
The managing partner is kind of an asshole though, right?
Well, yeah, I guess in full disclosure, maybe you probably have to disclose your relationship to our founder and managing partner.
Yeah, no, Soberus Capital is the family office of my much more successful but much less good-looking older brother Andy, where he makes up in intelligence and in wealth creation. He definitely lacks in looks, but really great guy to learn from in the healthcare space.
I think I've got to defend his honor, David. Otherwise, I might get fired. You're like, I won't step into the looks department, but I will definitely emphasize that Andy is probably one of the best healthcare investors out there, and an incredible person to learn from.
What is some of the, most thought-provoking, interesting bites investment advice he's given you over the last 5 years you've worked for him?
I would say it's very situational. I think that Andy, and frankly, other folks on the team too, have seen a lot in their careers. And so when you're approaching a situation, for the first time in your career, there's just a tremendous wealth of experience to draw from somebody who's probably seen it a dozen times, in their career, and can kind of extrapolate the best practices, the right way to approach things, which, in investing, a lot of the work of an early stage investor is pretty unstructured. You're just trying to achieve certain outcomes, and there's no real roadmap to go get there. So having the ability to learn from people who have done it before, over and over again with tremendous success. I think that is sort of just invaluable. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, it's every week or every month there's, you know, as you know, tons of situations that arise in early stage companies where that level of experience can be really, really helpful.
Yeah, things that you think probably are, you know, unique really just aren't when you've just had so many decades of experience of investing in early stage.
The gravity too, right, of a single situation can sometimes feel like a lot. And I think when you've spent your career investing, you understand which are the things that are really the important areas to focus on and which areas not to stress as much about. And so having the ability to kind of stack rank the right areas to spend your time and pay attention to, that's actually another area where the experience is just tremendously valuable.
That's actually really interesting. So, like, where would you say, you know, levels of anxiety from your career have kind of built up, you know, whereas, you know, when you talk to the gray hairs, they say, yeah, this isn't a big deal. It happens all the time.
You know, the first place that comes to mind, if you think of the life cycle of an investment, is when you submit a term sheet, right? You're trying to come up with the structure of a transaction. As someone earlier in your career, you're worried about all the things that could go wrong and that you didn't account for in the term sheet. So being able to talk to folks and get advice on what are those areas that actually are really important, the right protections to have, the right governance to put into place at the onset, versus the areas that are just going to be kind of marginal and nice to haves and, you know, frankly, only going to play out in a very sort of black swan type of scenario. That's an area where it's really helpful. And then after you make an investment, I think the areas where it's really helpful to have that kind of experience around the table is in figuring out what your role as the investor actually is, right? I think there's a full spectrum of investors. Some are completely hands off and, you know, here's the money and good luck. And then there's a bunch of investors who really tout being highly operational and highly involved. We're probably closer to the latter side of the spectrum, but frankly, knowing when to insert yourself and when to be hands off is something that comes with experience and time. And when you're early in your career, everything feels like a fire where you should be trying to provide advice and get involved. And I think that over time, you develop a better sense for where are the areas you can actually move the needle. And those could be things like key hires or, you know, trying to find material customer introductions or partnership relationships for your portfolio companies versus sweating the details on very specific things that are better managed at the company level, right? So I think those are all areas where having someone who's done it for, you know, over 40 years at a very high level is just, you know, really great opportunity.
How do you go about getting that founder buy-in on your operational expertise? And how do you suss out if that's actually like, if they're just smile fucking you in the pre-investment process to get you to do a deal with them versus them actually wanting help and are open to that type of involvement?
It's a good question because I think that naturally coming in as investor, you're sort of at, you're never going to be as in the details as an entrepreneur or the operators of the organization, right? And frankly, you shouldn't be, and those are the people who should be running the company. But where I think you can establish credibility with the teams that you're working with is spending a lot of time in the details, really understanding their metrics, really understanding their financials at a depth where you can start to help them think through how the operations are going to tie to the financial metrics or operating metrics that they're trying to achieve, right? I think that's an area where as an investor, you have a tremendous amount of focus on what are we trying to achieve on this year's budget, for example, and then what are the operational levers that are going to drive those outcomes. Knowing those really, really tightly gives you a lot of credibility when you then speak to founders, management teams to kind of advise them on how, you know, you think certain operational levers are going to impact the outcomes that the board is going to care about and their investors are going to care about. So I think you got to put in the time and the effort. And I think it's a process too, right? There typically takes a few instances where you've demonstrated your expertise on the business and your value to the company. And over time it's, you know, it's the kind of thing where if you're doing your job right, you become, you know, the trusted person for that operator or that entrepreneur or that management team, you know, member, maybe that's the CEO or whoever you work with closely at the company, where they're like, you know, you're the point person that helps them out. And it takes time to build that relationship. And as you know, early stage investing, these companies take 5 to 10 years to season and grow. And there's tons of problems and situations that arise along the way. So plenty of opportunities to kind of build that relationship.
Yeah. And you can lose that relationship too.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, I think if investors are doing their jobs, it's not just sitting on the sideline being a cheerleader for the company. There are some investors that have more of that model. But I think a good relationship, there is some back and forth. There is, you know, there are times where you're not agreeing, and handling that, going back to our earlier point, is an area where as you have more experience navigating those conversations, I think that's an area where you can actually start getting better and better as you progress through your career. Exactly. But you're right. I mean, you can totally, you know, find yourselves completely at odds, and that those are probably the areas where, you know, being a really good partner to somebody, you know, requires a level of communication and ability to achieve buy-in from the company that is not easy to achieve, right? And it takes time to build that skill set.
No, absolutely. One of the things I've learned in a very, very painful way is, and I fail at this also, I call it just having momentary relapses, where my own anxiety basically has a transference right onto the management team, frustration, passive aggressiveness that basically is not overly helpful at the end of the day.
Yeah, totally. And frankly, when you think about the situations that arise, these problems and challenges, I think one area we spend a lot of time on our team is just trying to identify all of the key risks that we think are going to be in play during the underwriting the investment. And so usually what we find is situations arise, but they're kind of covered under the umbrella of what we expected could go wrong, right? And then typically, if you've kind of pre-thought about what could go wrong, you have at least a little bit of an action plan on what to do next. Not to say that there's situations, right, or problems that come up totally out of the blue, that you, the unknown unknowns, right? And so the more you can kind of scope out what you think could go wrong, the more you can be sure that, you know, the investment you're making is a right, it's all about having a fair reward for the level of risk that you're taking. And so making sure you know what those risks are, I think, also help down the line, because you're less likely to be blindsided, less likely to get on tilt about something because it's something that you expected or thought about.
Yeah, exactly. That's a really great way to look at it. And how from that was a really great overview on how you and Sopris as a collective interact with portfolio companies. How does Sopris differentiate in capital allocation strategy, entry and exit, and from other early stage Series A, you know, type firms that are more, you know, venture-y, quote unquote?
Totally. I think one of the advantages of having the family office style of investing is that you're sort of more aligned with the company in the sense that we don't have to go out and raise that next fund with a bunch of outside LPs. And so we're not incentivized to go just raise round after round of capital to show a bunch of markups to go impress LPs to give us, you know, fund two or three or four or whatever, right? So, you know, as it relates to entry and exit, we can be a lot more flexible. And there have been situations in our portfolio where companies have, you know, become cash flowing, and that's a way we've made our return. And there have been companies that have come to us as early as a year or two into the investment and have signaled there's really interesting acquisition interest that they want to explore. That's another way we can make a good return. But I think the long-term patient capital gives you a lot of flexibility to ride the waves that any early stage company is going to go through without being super fixated on, you know, we've got to exit within 3 years or 5 years, whatever the timeline tends to be for funds that are more focused on putting up some returns on the scoreboard so they can kind of keep funding their operations.
Yeah. Or we just got to keep raising money. And if like the true metric of the founder is like that next fundraise, like how damaging that actually could be, because, you know, any person that's worth their salt knows that these things usually die by self imploding rather than like competitive forces.
Right. Yeah. It's a great point.
Yeah. It's just the overscale, no matter what it is. It's, you know, too much too soon. And, you know, just adds to the complete demise of the company.
Yeah, I tend to find that a lot of entrepreneurs and management teams that are thinking about capitalizing their businesses are always so worried that they might not raise enough right now to go capture the market or win the market. And they're doing themselves a disservice by not raising as much capital as possible, regardless of what stage the company is in, right? And, you know, frankly, there are some advantages to raising more capital, but I find that companies, as they find really attractive product market fit and prove out their economics and start to do things that make them look like attractive, profitable businesses, there's never a shortage of an opportunity to go out and raise more capital to support all of that. So versus overcapitalizing before you have those things, you know, as you discover those things along the way, which tends to be the case, especially in healthcare where we spend our time, you know, the more measured approach and taking less and, you know, throttling the gas pedal as you start to see the indications that you might have a good exit or you might have the opportunity to build tremendous enterprise value or something like that in your company. That's something that I think more people are starting to think about now, especially as capital markets become maybe more challenging or tighter or there's a lot more scrutiny on companies. And I think a lot of folks are thinking, do I need to raise, you know, a huge seed round or a huge Series A round, or should I have a more measured approach?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I've heard a lot from the Series C and later guys. The best assets just aren't raising because, you know, they just don't feel like they need to because they've got great unit economics. Whereas before, everyone was getting paid for the growth, and that's not necessarily true anymore.
Totally. And I've seen markets where it makes more sense to raise a ton of money and try and go and win the market. But I would say in healthcare, again, that's where we spend a lot of our time. The pace of change in healthcare is glacial across any part of this industry. And so there are very few companies that need a massive war chest to go win the market in 2 or 3 years, because it just, you know, your sales cycle with your customer is probably going to be 2 or 3 years. Even
if it doesn't pencil regardless. Yeah. Like there's no fast, you can't really accelerate it.
Right. And so that I think has been a challenge for a lot of companies that maybe raise too much capital, but you just cannot get over some of the obstacles in this industry through capital alone, whereas you may be able to do that in other places.
Do you feel like, I mean, and then, you know, you guys also have a wide breadth in tech-enabled services. How do you think about growth within tech-enabled? You know, essentially, because you don't necessarily always get paid for as much of the growth as you do in just straight B2B SaaS. You know, I heard a great quote from somebody in healthcare services and healthcare tech enabled. And they were just like, you know, if you just don't think about this as a SaaS company, you generally can do pretty well and just have those kinds of expectations.
Totally. I mean, I would say that a lot of the businesses we look at, you know, they converge to looking like tech enabled services over time, because I think that is one of the prevailing models in healthcare, right? I think there are a few sort of software pure play opportunities, but most of the really attractive opportunities are going to have some flavor of services on top of them. And, you know, I think as you think about things like valuation and how do you be successful investing in a tech enabled services company, I think what that person told you is probably the right way to go in, eyes open, realizing you're investing in a tech enabled services business. That means that whatever scale you get to where it makes sense to think about looking for an exit, you're going to get a tech-enabled services multiple, right? And the tech enablement of the service should be reflected in the company's economics and the gross profit and the ability to scale, you know, versus being maybe a traditional service that is not tech-enabled. If you know that going into it, you can sort of price a deal on the front end appropriately. If you go into an investment and price it like a SaaS investment, and then it turns out to be more of a tech-enabled service, you're going to eat a lot of valuation compression just on that multiple compression from being a SaaS company to being a tech-enabled services company. So I think that's where, especially in healthcare, it's really important to understand or spend a lot of time thinking about what does the company look like at scale or in a couple of years when they've started to, you know, demonstrate more commercial traction. Is it going to be pure play software, which is typically rare? Or are you going to have some people who are helping the customers get the value out of the technology that you're building for them?
Yeah, I heard from another tech-enabled service person that, you know, you usually make that mistake once of valuing a tech-enabled service company, hopefully, like a SaaS company.
Hopefully it's never fair, but oftentimes you get burned, right?
Yeah, no, it's just one of those. If it's more service than tech and the tech never really fully matures, it's could be a really, really painful learning lesson.
Yeah, but you can build a great tech-enabled services business in healthcare. You can have a great outcome. You can have a venture scale outcome on a tech-enabled service, but it requires understanding what business you're actually in, and not. And I think there is sometimes an aversion from investors against services because they kind of internally know that if, hey, this is a services business, the multiple is going to be lower, and the chance that I can have the billion-dollar outcome or whatever is lower. But frankly, you can build a lot of scale with a great tech-enabled service. I mean, the healthcare, typically the addressable market in healthcare is just huge.
It's unbelievably huge. And there's not like a lot of competitive risk because the market's so big, right? There's just enough meat on the bone for everybody. You just have to play tighter.
Absolutely. Right. And there's a lot of low hanging fruit. There's a lot of medium hanging fruit. There's a lot of opportunity to create value for stakeholders across the sort of landscape. And if you can do that, I think you can capture a lot of that value in your own organization.
So what's getting you excited in the healthcare sphere? I mean, I am an avid reader of VIX picks. So I'd love to know kind of what you're thinking about in 2024 as some of the low-hanging fruit and the opportunities for disruption.
Yeah, I would say there's a few areas. First, I would caveat by saying we're not the most thematically driven investors, frankly, because I think the themes in healthcare take a long time to play out. Just at the Vive conference this week, there were probably five or six panels on value-based care, right? People have been talking about value-based care 10 years ago. They're talking about it today. They'll probably be talking about it in 10 years because it takes a long time for things to change. So just knowing what the prevailing trends in the industry are isn't really enough to know whether or not you've got a great investment because there's so much of this is on execution. But I'd say that if there is a broad-based theme that I'm thinking about personally, and I haven't exactly thought about the right way to invest behind the theme yet, I would say it's kind of this broad-based decentralization of healthcare. I think that if you zoom out and look at what healthcare could look like in 10 years or 20 years even, I think it looks more decentralized than it is today. And I think there's two reasons for it. One is on the supply side and one is on the demand side. On the supply side, I think we've known for a decade now that we don't have enough clinicians. And that's in every category, physicians and mid-level providers and nurses. And, you know, when that supply starts to become more constrained, that, you know, the access problem, which is already such a big challenge for people all over the country, especially in rural areas, right? Or areas of where the access is constrained for other reasons. I think that means that, you know, you just don't have the level of, you know, connectivity to your clinical providers that maybe you used to have. I think people always talk about the idea of like the family doctor, you know, from decades ago, where that person would know you and your history and spend a lot of time with you. Today, the average primary care physician has like a 2,500 to 3,000 patient census. And when you go see your primary care provider, unless you're very lucky to have a great concierge practice or direct primary care where the patient panel is much lower, you're probably seeing that person for a few minutes and they're kind of reading through your chart and making a very, you know, a quick interaction with you to try and get you on your way because they've got 20 more visits to do that day or 20 more encounters to do that day. And so lack of access, I think, is a big challenge, and I think it pushes people outside of the confines of the traditional healthcare system, right? If you just can't get an appointment with a psychiatrist or you just can't get an appointment with a dermatologist, you are going to start to look for other ways to find care, right? And then on the other side, on the demand side, there's all kinds of new technology that's enabling people to take more ownership over their healthcare. And I think there's a greater interest in that from a lot of people. You know, I'm thinking of a few things that have emerged more recently, but this idea of like, you know, getting a, you know, super diagnostic exam where you're doing, you know, 100 different tests. And there's a couple of companies that have started to sort of put the hands of diagnostic exams in the hands of the patient, charging you a lot for it. But I think there's a lot of people who feel like, yeah, you know, I don't know if I'm getting the right level of scrutiny or care from my provider, so I want to take that into my own hands. There's so many people today who are getting their medical information from social media as opposed to a clinician, right? And it's just interesting to see how, as people start looking for help and care outside of the confines of the clinic, there is going to be more technology and more ways for them to do that. And I think the thing layered on top of all of this is, you know, the demographic shift that's taking place in the country now, where you have an aging population, which by very kind of nature means that the healthcare needs of the population will become more acute. And I think a lot of folks are going to be put into the position of being a caregiver, right? And that's a challenging spot for most people because it's something that's thrust upon you. A lot of people don't have a medical or clinical background, and they're not, you know, necessarily, it's not something that they're capable of doing without help. And I think it'll be interesting to see where that all meets, right? Is there a really interesting technology or services that help people manage this sort of shift into becoming, into taking more ownership of their own healthcare and the healthcare of their loved ones?
Yeah. And like, I feel like the people are just so much more educated, and it's just much more top of mind, right? As opposed to the baby boomer. Like, now that I'm turning 40 this year, which is disgusting. I look and, you know, you meet guys, you have, you know, and, you know, colleagues that are 55 and, you know, they die prematurely because of cancer that, you know, could have been screened for, but it's not, you know, usual and customary. I just knew two people that had upper esophageal cancer, and, you know, you get your rectal exam when you're 50, but, you know, you don't really go in through the other way unless you specially request that. And now, you know, that is one example of probably hundreds that people are now asking for, or asking for that additional task, asking for like checking markers for cancer or metabolic disease. And I just see these doctors, like these underpaneled doctors in these managed care services, they're like getting so pissed, you know, they're getting talked to, right? Because they're running these tests that aren't deemed medically necessary because, you know, they're seeing it. And, you know, they don't even know what these tests are. Like, I went to my doctor. I was shocked. I mean, I've never felt so old in my life when, like, my doctor was 10 years old when he walked through the door. And I'm like, this is, you know, usually the first sign was when, like, you realize athletes are much younger than you. And then, like, the second is when the doctor came in when he was 10. Like, he was like, he had like a lollipop in his mouth. It was like embarrassing.
That is really funny. and frankly, it's an experience a lot of folks will have, I think, as the one area where the clinician sort of supply is showing some legs of growth is in this category of like advanced practice practitioners. And what they, so this is like nurse practitioners and what am I thinking of? Physician assistants, right? It's actually advanced practice providers. And that's nurse practitioners and physician assistants. And there's a tremendous amount of growth in this category because I think, especially as you think about all these like tech-enabled service models, you're trying to find ways to take the existing supply and have it meet the demand in a way that's economic. And if you can find someone who can do like 70 to 80% of what the physician can do at, you know, some marginally or materially lower cost, then that can make those economics work a lot better. But then, you know, I think patients will have to start to get more comfortable if they're not comfortable for whatever reason with the fact that the person that they're seeing maybe didn't go to medical school or didn't go through all the rigorous training that a physician would kind of tout as the reason that they should be put into a different category than one of these advanced practice providers. So it's interesting. Like, I think there is going to be an interesting trend of how do you take the supply that exists? And frankly, I think it's going to be, there will be breakdowns where the option is you get no care or you get care from a more junior person. And, you know, between those two choices, I think most people would take the person that, you know, typically has a lot of experience and, you know, is scoped to do a lot. But, you know, if you can't see a physician, this is, you know, typically just as good of an option clinically, although there's a lot of debate about that between the two groups. But, you know, the alternative being no care is, I think, pretty.
Yeah, or you come out of pocket and pay the difference, right? And, you know, people usually will then succumb to probably the lower level of, or the juniorization, as you call it, of healthcare.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I talked to a psychiatrist recently. This might be interesting, but you know, this person was saying, we've got a mental health urgent care business, which is largely staffed by nurse practitioners, psychiatric nurse practitioners. And that enables them to build a practice where you can be seen same day, next day, and they accept your insurance. And what the psychiatrist was saying was, hey, I have all this experience that a nurse practitioner doesn't. They don't know how to like triage the patient the right way. They just follow the playbook more than, you know, what I do is this, I ask all these questions and I get to know the patient really well. And, you know, I asked him like, well, do you take insurance? Right. And the answer was no. And right. These are, you know, 90 minute cash pay only sessions. And that's great if you can afford that. And there will be a lot of people who want that level of service. But there are a lot of people who will benefit from something that looks more like, you know, even in that person's perspective, maybe lower touch care. But, you know, it doesn't mean it's bad care and it doesn't mean it won't meet the needs of the patient.
Well, no, exactly. It's like the dirty ashtray thing. It's like, you know, you want to make sure that, you know, it good is second to best, right? It's not best versus nothing. And there's a huge piece of the bell curve that needs to be seen that aren't being seen.
Totally. Totally agree.
So Vic, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, David. This was, I always love chatting with you. So this was, no different.
How do I get more Vic's picks? Like, I feel like you need to be held accountable to writing more content. I'm going to start paying you. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to actually start paying you for your Substack. And if I don't see something weekly, I'm going to be pissed.
It's hard. I tend to write these longer form pieces, which just take me a long time to write. I'm not a great writer. And it's something that the whole reason I got into this was to become a better writer. A lot of the best investors that I think that, you know, I really respect and admire are just tremendous writers. And I don't know, man, it just takes a long time to put one of those posts together. So when I have more time, you know, typically if you see me post a lot, that's because I've got nothing going on that morning or something like that. So, you know,
Who are your favorite investors? Who you got investor crushes on?
Investor crushes. Well, you know, I think with respect to like folks, I will read basically anything they put out. I love everything that Howard Marks puts out, all of his memos. I mean, I think I print them out and read them as soon as they come out. The first fund I worked at that I mentioned in college was, you know, the folks there were kind of disciples of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. So, of course, anything that they put out is really interesting. But one thing I encourage people to do, especially people who are like thinking about working in venture capital or any kind of investing, but feel like they don't have the right investment, you know, chops or background or something like that, is a lot of hedge funds publicly publish, you know, their letters, their quarterly letters, where they're taking stock of their portfolio and everything that happened that quarter, the things that went well, things that went wrong, and new positions that they're taking on. And I find those to be really interesting. I don't always know the managers behind the funds that are putting this stuff out there, but you know, you typically, seeing someone write out their thoughts, I think, conveys a sense of like clairvoyance about the way that they're seeing things that I aspire to. So, you know, I wouldn't say that there's any one or two that really stick out. But, you know, as you read a bunch of them, you start to get a sense for how does a really smart person think about pricing risk and whether they're being paid appropriately for the risk that they're taking.
That's awesome. Well, everybody, that concludes another episode of the Capital Stack. I'm going to add something else into this podcast. If you've listened to this podcast, I want to hear from you because I want to ask you questions about why you listen and I want to make the podcast better. So please reach out to me at david@dwpcapital.com or LinkedIn, David Paul, where you can just say, hey, I listen to the Capital Stack. I'm looking to focus it in, dial it in, the stuff that's valuable, and push out the stuff that's not. So again, thank you so much for listening. We drop an episode every Tuesday and we will see you next week. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the Capital Stack Podcast. Make sure to share this with someone you know that can benefit from this content. Remember to support this show by rating, reviewing, and subscribing. David Paul is the founder and general partner at DWP Capital. All opinions expressed by David and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of DWP Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. David and guests may maintain positions in the securities discussed on this podcast.